Question. There are so many diverse spiritual movements springing up. What do you think of the more fanatical ones, especially where young people appear to break so with our culture? Answer. Although I found it is hard enough to determine what's going on inside of me, let alone to judge others, I do feel that it is very important to avoid hurting anyone else in one's spiritual quest. And as a psychiatrist, I feel that fanaticism and violent change usually do not reflect mature judgment. Frequently, when an individual attempts to make too drastic a change in his behavior, harmful rebounds take place. For instance, if one tries to fast without preparing for this departure from routine, the fast may end with gorging. Too unnatural a spiritual path can tire one quickly and end up leading away from God rather than toward Him. Or it can frustrate one into changing paths in a fickle manner so that no one direction is ever maintained for long. How does one launch upon a spiritual path that is actually meant by surrender, renunciation, and detachment? Must one make dramatic, violent changes in his way of life, torturing the body, despising the mind, throwing aside everything he has learned, and taking to the forest, giving up all actions unless receiving concrete directions from spirits and entities from other dimensions? It seems to me that spiritual doctrine is easy to misinterpret, especially when Westerners are trying to understand rather involved and esoteric Eastern practices. I myself am a beginner, a real novice into the subject of spirituality, and I wholeheartedly direct the reader to Sai Baba's own discourses for an in-depth study. His works are beautiful, his message profound. Yet from the standpoint of a psychiatrist, I would like to point out what I consider some misinterpretations of spiritual teachings. I do this to caution some about becoming fanatical and to assure others that they don't have to become crazy or weird or dramatically change their lifestyles to embark on the spiritual path. Misinterpretation of religious doctrine may be in part why these ancient truths have fallen into disrepute for so many. After my own experience with Sai Baba, I understand why it is so common for errors to be made. First of all, many of us are not very far along spiritually, and in general have limited vision, little self-discipline, and poor judgment with respect to reality and the way we should govern our lives. Add to this an intoxication with Baba's greatness and beauty and the shattering of previously held notions of reality, together with the awakening of a deep-seated yearning to merge with God, and you can see how easy it is to lose one's bearing. I have observed many people adopting contorted and distorted behavior, trying first one thing and then another, if that doesn't work in a few days, attempting in a frenzied and undisciplined manner to feel God, yet not knowing exactly what it is they're trying to attain. I've already mentioned that the confusion that exists both in the individual and in psychiatric practice in mistaking detachment for repression. Another of the central mistakes I have observed in launching upon the path Baba has revealed to us is our desire to reach our destination too quickly. In this case, we may repress rather than detach, play roles instead of extending ourselves honestly, appear foolish to others rather than providing a believable and inspiring example. Baba constantly teaches patients Yet people frequently adopt fanatical and unrealistic lifestyles in order to make headway fast. If one is practicing hatha yoga and his body is stiff and inflexible, it is dangerously foolish to attempt some of the advanced asanas or postures too quickly. Torn ligaments, tendons, and muscles can be the result. The body must learn slowly and with patience. The art of hatha yoga lies in being able to sense where one's physical boundaries are, not tormenting the body and oneself because one isn't able to execute some advanced posture, but gently hovering at a particular boundary, asking and encouraging the body to open up more. The same is true of people wishing to emulate great saints who are able to take to the Himalayas and live in the bitter cold with little food or shelter, meditating 24 hours a day. If we don't know what those saints know, just as our bodies are not as flexible as those of great yogis, then to try to emulate them totally is, of course, utter foolishness. We will only torment and hurt ourselves. When a person is making gains in his emotional life through psychiatric therapy, there is only a gradual integration of what one learns into the fabric of what he has been. I believe this to be a sign that knowledge has been integrated into the deepest reaches of the personality, in contrast to something only cerebrally and superficially understood. When people act as if they know something, when in fact their knowledge is no deeper than the cerebral level, they appear to me unreal. And I must admit that a lot of people passing themselves off as spiritual appear to me to be in this category. Question: what is your feeling about people involved in phenomenology? Answer: many people seemed wrapped up in talking to their dead relatives or in learning how to see auras or move objects at a distance, calling upon the karmic board or the purple flame or whatever other esoteric symbol they believed in order to develop powers such as the ability to cure an illness or to overcome a particular problem in their lives. I feel that our most important spiritual work is to learn to keep intimate company with God, focusing and meditating on Him always, learning to lead our lives as a devotional service and expressing this devotion and love in very practical and concrete ways in our everyday relationships with people. Baba and many others have said that yogic powers can tempt and detour the spiritual aspirant from the main goal of merging with God. People can get so caught up in excitement over what in the West we generally call extrasensory or paranormal powers that they forget that even these, like aggressiveness and sexuality, may lead deeper into the state of ego, the state of wanting and demanding, of frustration and suffering, the state of duality. It doesn't have to follow, however, that if one breaks into higher levels of awareness and develops some extraordinary powers, he is bound to go astray. One can master and transcend these higher powers the same as the more common energies, but this calls for considerable discipline. Question: what does Baba say about taking mind-altering drugs? Answer: as a psychiatrist, I have come to see that the most central human drive is to merge with God, who is our true identity, to return to the safety and strength of the Father. I see the fascination with psychedelic drugs as an expression of our yearning to lose the small self and make contact and merge with a higher reality. There is little doubt that one of the important elements of the drug experience is the diminishment of the importance of the personality or ego as one is caught up, enveloped, and submerged in a new world of swirling energies. Baba has said frequently, however, that this is not the path to true merging, but a dead-end street. The transcendent experience brought about by drugs, however illuminating it may be of the fact the reality as most of us know it, is in fact an arbitrary sort of tunnel vision in a world of phenomena of which we are mostly ignorant, is nevertheless false and transient itself, and does not lead to true insight. Baba, as a matter of fact, has likened such experience to a plastic grape. Instant and lasting samadhi is apparently not to be found in a pill. Baba is always teaching about patience, perseverance, and discipline. Together with God's grace, these learned virtues are what make it possible to meet God within ourselves. Baba has promised that if we enter upon the experiment and experience of spiritual discipline, He will be with us in an intimate way, guiding us, assuring our safety, helping us to reach the goal of genuine self-realization. What more can a teacher promise? Question: does one have to go to India to make contact with Sai Baba? Answer: no. He frequently makes contact with people all over the world in different ways. I know individuals, for example, who have been thousands of miles from him, when a picture they have of him will begin to produce vibhuti. Or they will have an eerie feeling that he is communicating with them, or he will come in a dream to teach. I've even talked to reputable people who claim to have seen him materialize right in front of them here in this country. It is clear to me now that the dimension of prayer or meditation is as likely and as fruitful a place to make contact with Baba as is the Indian village of Puttaparthi. Baba tells the story of a devotee who is in great danger and about to be assaulted. The devotee called upon the name and form of God to which he was devoted, picturing the deity at his place of residence as described in Hindu scriptures many miles away. He prayed until almost overcome by his attackers. Only at the last moment did God appear and save him. When he asked God why he had taken so long in coming, God replied that he had to come from a long distance because the devotee had pictured him so far away. Had the devotee pictured him within his own heart, he could have been there instantaneously. Question: does this mean that if we want Baba to appear to us, he will come? Answer: Baba says he is the indweller in each and every one of our hearts, and if we look for him there, we will find him. But as for his actions on the physical plane, it is my understanding that his movements are not determined by our wants or desires, but by our devotion, our spiritual practice, and his grace. While one of my friends, a psychiatrist named Warren Gershwin, was visiting Baba recently, his wife and a young woman working as their housekeeper were sitting at their home talking. Sylvia, the housekeeper, had been brought up in Tijuana, Mexico, in a rather difficult family setting, and was a hard-working, stable, and very healthy young woman. This evening, she was a bit sad, and said to Warren's wife, Madeline, that even though she sang bhajans and wanted to believe in Baba, she simply wasn't convinced of his special powers. Madeline was trying to comfort her, but without much luck. Sylvia looked up at the mantel where Baba's picture was hanging and silently asked him for help in building her faith. Madeline relates that all of a sudden Sylvia's face turned ashen and she began muttering, "Oh my God, oh my God," then ran into the kitchen. Madeline, frightened that Sylvia had seen a prowler, quickly followed her to determine what had her so upset. Quote, "As I looked away from the mantel and into the kitchen, I saw Baba in plain view, walking past the doorway. She said, in an awed whisper, 'Now I understand why you sing bhajans.' She wanted to sleep there in the kitchen, and that evening they sang bhajans until 2 in the morning. Question. If I went to India, what would be the probability of seeing and talking with Baba? Answer. That is really between you and Baba. There is no way of telling what he will do, although in general it is already difficult to see him. If you are seriously considering taking such a trip, I suggest contacting one of the Sai Baba centers to see whether a group of devotees is planning one. There might be a better chance of seeing Baba by going with a group. If you wish to go alone, I suggest inquiring of one of the centers where Baba will be at the time of your anticipated visit. This information, along with a current list of the centers nearest you, may be obtained by writing the Sri Satya Sai Book Center of America. The bookstore address, together with a list of available books by and about Baba, are included in the appendix. I must remind you that the setting in Puttaparthi is austere. There are many obstacles to overcome, and the trip is difficult in many ways. But for the real seeker, the possibility of ending your search is great." Question. "When will he come to the United States?" Answer. "That's a good question. Nobody knows Baba's plans, itineraries, or movements, and he frequently fakes his followers out of their shoes when they try to outguess him. So far, the only place he has traveled outside of India is Africa in 1968. Americans have been asking him for years when he will come, and his answer is that he will come when we are ready. I was present when one young man asked him this, and Baba replied that he would be going home with him, then patted him on the chest over his heart. I feel that he was indeed come to this country in the hearts of thousands of Americans who have been touched by him. To another person, he said that first one must take care of himself, and when that has been mastered, one takes care of his family, then his neighbors, then his city, and finally his country. Then one can go to other countries. It seems plain that he plans to focus on the healing and rejuvenation that must go on in India before he will direct himself elsewhere." Question. "How has your experience with Sai Baba affected the way you practice psychiatry?" Answer. "I've experienced a basic change in attitude, which is reflected in my work. First of all, since meeting Sai Baba, I have become happier and more at peace, having lost to a great extent my fear of death, while gaining a sense of omnipresent protection. This basic change in outlook and feeling of security have brought a clearer focus and sense of direction to my life, and consequently, I feel able to perceive others more clearly also. I have gone through quite a change in attitude toward the place of feelings and emotions in life. I became aware of the dangers of repressing feeling as a result of my psychiatric training, and after meeting Baba, I have grown to recognize as well the dangers inherent in being overly attached to feelings and the manner in which such attachment can absolutely curtail spiritual growth. In some strange way, psychiatrists are almost trained to become agnostics and atheists, perhaps by their overvaluation of and fascination with feelings and emotions, they overlook a spiritual order of reality beyond the senses. There naturally follows in their therapeutic objectives an emphasis on the senses and emotions. These elements of the small self have expanded in importance until they are the framework of what is practically worship in contemporary psychiatry. I feel that there are some major limitations in psychiatric theory and practice which should be brought to the patient's attention. It is true that untold numbers of people with emotional problems are helped to deal with them by an investigation into their feelings and thoughts. Many have to become more deeply involved with feelings in order to get to a point where they understand and can control their reactions. But there is a limit to the amount of growth and evolution attainable through being immersed in these systems, and I think that psychiatry should make it clear where these limitations are, that after a certain point, being immersed in feeling for the sheer joy and release of actually experienced aggression or sexuality, without governing these feelings with a well-developed sense of morality, is dangerous. Psychiatry must not be afraid to own up to a morality that reflects the existence of a spiritual dimension, and to define proper channels of conduct which will lead to spiritual growth. Even though at one point in treatment it is appropriate to be non-judgmental and ask the patient not to censor thoughts or suppress emotions, it must be made clear that this attitude is a dangerous one if generalized as a way of life. Although most psychiatrists would say such generalization is a gross misunderstanding of the psychiatric attitude, it is my feeling that psychiatry has in some measure contributed to this distorted view by society at large. In refusing to acknowledge a spiritual dimension beyond the senses, it, in effect, overvalues them. Before meeting Sai Baba, I misinterpreted such monistic spiritual practices as detachment from emotions and adherence to a self-controlled, disciplined mode of morality as generally repressive. In fact, a pathological denial of one's basic identity. I thought one's identity was primarily emotional. So this attitude about a more limited place of emotions in a person's life and the need for therapists more openly and clearly to discuss morality and the appropriate modes of behavior necessary for one's spiritual development is reflected in my therapy. This can be done, I found, without the patient's feeling punished or criticized, and without stopping the flow of material necessary to reveal his repressed feelings. I came to realize that I had been taking cover under the mask of the non-judgmental observer much more frequently than was necessary or appropriate. Psychiatry, I feel, must become spiritualized. Quote, education without character, science without humanity, and commerce without morality are useless and dangerous, unquote, Baba says, making the point further while defining the limited place of the senses in one's life by using the camera as an example. Like ourselves, the camera is pointed to the world to receive information. The mind is the energy force that directs the camera in any number of ways toward the world. A higher aspect of the mind, called buddhi or intellect, directs the mind to what is important to photograph and tells it how to frame and focus. The senses are like the lens through which the information must travel to get to the film. And the film on which the image is exposed is the heart. If the intellect is wise and discriminating in its choices, one can consistently develop photographs exquisite in the truth and beauty they reveal of life. The bliss that comes from viewing what one feels to be a moment of absolute truth captured in a photograph is analogous to the divine experience. Just as the purpose of photography is not fulfilled in stimulating the lens, neither is the purpose of life in exciting the senses. If the use of the camera is governed not by intelligence, but by sheer sensation of energy passing through the lens, then, of course, the images on the film will represent a chaotic picture of the world. I now perceive, in patients' verbalizations, and even in their body language, a certain vibration or element which went unnoticed before, and which I now identify as spiritual concerns and issues. While still able to identify conflicts centering around aggression or sexuality, I am more aware of the spiritual dimension, always there before, but only dimly perceived or even considered neurotic. Where previously I saw only neurotic dependency in an adult who wanted a loving father's protection, I now also see elements of the very real sense of helplessness and isolation that comes from feeling separate from God, and perceive a spiritual yearning for merging with Him. Where I could see only neurotic fear in a patient who withdrew from expressing sexuality or aggression, I now also see an intuitive spiritual understanding which moves an individual toward detachment from emotions, and which perceives the danger in being too involved with feelings. Or in a patient overly concerned with being kind and gentle and loving, who appears to be defending against the expression of more animalistic drives, I might also see the yearning to merge with God by taking on those qualities which will lead one to Him. And with the patient I once thought dealing solely with neurotic guilt, condemning himself and anticipating punishment, I may more readily investigate his perceived past sins and his intuitive spiritual awareness of the need for repentance, or a fear of God he may be experiencing because of karma, the need to repay in kind for all one's actions. We may even talk about the possibility of a particular conditions having arisen as the result of an action in a previous life. A patient who understands something about the concept of reincarnation may derive sufficient strength from his conception to help him through a period of mental torment or depression. Whereas I used to see only a masochistic preoccupation with loneliness and depression in a widow or widower who would not date after the death of a spouse, I now also see the spiritual drive to treat the union as sacred, to observe chastity and transcend the physical plane of existence for a higher relationship with God and a loved one quite definitely experienced, although no longer at this plane of existence. I used to regard as distraught those musings by the depressed patient that he might be picking up vibrations from a loved one separated by a distance or death. I am now willing to consider this a possibility. The reality of some such human capability has been brought home dramatically to me in more than one instance. For example, I was seeing a patient who was doing well with no obvious cause for depression, who nevertheless pinpointed for me the exact time and day of the development of a rather profound depression, which lasted about 10 days. Not until weeks later did she learn that her closest male friend, with whom she had not been in contact for some months, had been contemplating suicide and had, at that moment, placed all his pills on the table before him while making his final decision. He decided not to kill himself, and his own depression subsided at almost the same rate of recovery that I witnessed in my patient. Spiritual issues are not the infrequent or peripheral concerns I used to consider them to be, but are, in fact, crucial and central ones at the heart of the patient's very existence. A psychiatrist becomes aware of those areas in a patient's life with which he has contact in his own, and is a healer of others to the extent that he has healed himself, integrating and harmonizing his own life energies. I practice yoga and meditation daily, and so bring elements of these disciplines into the treatment setting to be practiced by the patient. For example, I may suggest meditation to help a patient quiet distracting thoughts or agitating emotions, or I may introduce certain yoga techniques and postures to bring energy and fluidity into constricted areas of the body. I try to maintain a meditative state myself in the treatment setting, relying on it more than on thoughts, feelings, or theories. I have developed great faith that this experience opens and sharpens my intuitive capacity while becoming transformed in some way into a method of treatment. Last, there is Sai Baba's most central message of love, a love that must be brought into the treatment setting. It has become apparent to me that contemporary psychiatry is grossly limited in understanding and comprehending the kind of love which he teaches. After my initial visit to Sai Baba and experience of the awakening of a devotional center within myself, I began to realize that in this reaction, I was witnessing something about the dynamics of love which had not been accessible to me in the field of psychiatry. This inner experience of devotion toward the divine is the fire in which our love becomes intensified, expanded, and purified. It is the source of our deepest sense of meaning, giving rise to our most profound experience of peace and love. Baba points out how centrally important devotion is in our lives. Quote, "Bhakti or devotion is the only path for reaching the divine destination. Bhakti is the only panacea for all the ills of the world. Bhakti is the only method of making you realize the truth." Unquote from Satya Sai Baba. I knew that I had to find a way to fill not only my therapy, but my whole life with this attitude. Most psychiatrists, myself included, have been trained to have a rather egotistical attitude about their role in the therapeutic process. The assumption that any person can ever fully understand human nature and cure others is not only a gross illusion, but also the source of a great deal of discomfort for many psychiatrists who strain under the burden of feeling that they should know everything. Being in Sai Baba's presence and witnessing the scope of his consciousness was enough to humble this psychiatrist anyway into acknowledging how much we do not know. There followed for me an attempt to change my entire attitude about what is actually being accomplished in the therapeutic process and what its goals and purposes are. Swami Vivekananda an Indian holy man and disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, said, quote, "All the work you do is done for your own salvation, is done for your own benefit. God has not fallen into a ditch for you and me to help him by building a hospital or something of that sort. He allows you to work not in order to help him, but that you may help yourself. Do you think that even an ant will die for want of your help? Most arrant blasphemy. The world does not need you at all. Cut out the word help from your mind. You cannot help. It is blasphemy. You worship when you give a morsel of food to a dog. You worship the dog as God. He is all and is in all. Be thankful that you are allowed to exercise your power of benevolence and mercy in the world and thus become pure and perfect. Be grateful to the man you help. Think of him as God. Is it not a privilege to be allowed to worship God by helping our fellow man?" End quote. Baba has put it this way, quote, "The play is his. The role is his gift. The lines are written by him. He directs. He decides the dress and decoration, the gesture and the tone, the entrance and the exit. You have to act well the part and receive his approbation when the curtain falls. Earn by your efficiency and enthusiasm to play higher and higher roles. That is the meaning and purpose of life." End quote. I have come to the belief that the therapeutic process is for the benefit of the therapist as well as the patient. I have attempted to make it an act of devotion and worship. If the therapist is meditating on the divine while in the therapeutic setting, if he sees the divine in the patient and maintains constant contact with this inner experience, he becomes more at peace, more loving, and more intuitive. I believe that the transformation of our souls takes place in this kind of atmosphere. Such a setting can't help but have a profound meaning for both patient and therapist. Baba has said, quote, "It is enough if love is cultivated, the love that knows no distinction between oneself and another, because all are but limbs of the one corpus of God Almighty. Through love alone can the embodiment of love be gained. Here no scholarship is needed. In fact, scholarship is an impediment, for it caters to egoism, and it breeds doubts and desires for disputation and the laurels of victory over others preening themselves as learned." End quote. Besides seeing the devotional attitude as centrally important in my own life, I have more than once encouraged a patient to investigate this attitude himself. When patients discuss their sense of isolation, depression, emptiness, and loneliness, I remind them, when I feel it is appropriate, of their relationship with God, suggesting that they spend time developing this spiritual relationship as well as their interpersonal relationships. I tell them plainly that their capacity to experience love is directly related to their fostering of a devotional attitude toward the divine. I have come to realize that through love, both the therapist and the patient can grow in the realization that our basic identity is Atma, that we, in fact, extend beyond time and space. People can experience the love that permeates and sustains the physical world. Appreciation of the spiritual reality of love as the ultimate energy of the universe, and a realization that devotion is the means by which our love unfolds and expands, should be the goal of treatment. The purpose of therapy, in other words, should be to ease suffering in bodily, emotional, and mental spheres, to thaw and loosen those areas hardened by pain. Then, one can open to the vibration of the energy of love, much as the lotus flower opens its petals to the sun, to be in intimate communion with the source of its life and beauty. The ultimate goal of psychiatry, I feel, is the same as that of religion, to find the God or Atma within through the experience of love. Reflecting my fervent hope that psychiatry awaken to the reality of Sai Baba, I myself would rather call this still young science Psychiatry, the Psychiatry of Atma Consciousness, the Psychiatry of Love. This chapter concludes with a quotation from Satya Sai Baba, quote, "The secret of liberation lies not in the mystic formula that is whispered in the ear and rotated on the rosary. It lies in the stepping out into action, walking forward in practice, the pious pilgrim route, and the triumphant reaching of the goal."